My name is John Shipton. I'm Julian Assange's father. For the last 3 years, I've been traveling the world, in particular, most of the time in the UK and Europe, and then 2 monthly trips into tours in the United States. And then now I'm back in the UK for the hearing that was on the 27th, 28th. That's yesterday and the day before.
Well, before you tell us about the hearing, can you say something about, your early days with Julian? I was looking at one of these big Australian documentaries they did. I think it was like an hour-long interview on 60 Minutes with Julian the other day from about a decade ago, and they were talking about Julian was talking about anti-nuclear campaigning back in Australia. This was a big business back when, certainly when I was a young man. People were just trying to make sure that the nuclear industry was kind of stopped in its tracks as much as possible, and certainly wasn't able to take the mickey in regards to safety. And now it seems we've got a whole sort of meeting of people up in Glasgow who think that nuclear is the best thing since sliced bread. So the tables have kind of turned. But can you just say something about those early days?
Yes, well, the nuclear proliferation of atom bombs and hydrogen bombs was our principal concern back then. Our activities were focused intensely because the testing zones were just off into the Pacific, which is, of course, Australia's front door. Also, it seemed odd after Nagasaki and Hiroshima that the states would arm themselves with thousands and thousands and thousands of atom bombs, simply enough to destroy each other and the world over and over again. It seemed to be a little bit mad. So we fought against that. Also, back then, it seemed to be a diversion of rural assets into sort of a war economy when there was no war and no war likely. And that sort of momentum seems to have continued. And now states devote under agreed laws that 2% of their, well, agreed diplomatic arrangements to devote 2% of their GNP to manufacture of weapons, munitions, and such. So that was our energy back then. It seems clear to me that we, to a large extent, failed. The proliferation stopped, but only stopped because those states that were fully armed didn't want anybody else to have the bombs. And we also seem to have failed in the sense that development of safe nuclear power stopped in its tracks, and closed nuclear cycles or thorium reactors or fusion reactors exploration stopped in its track too. So it seems to have failed at a number of levels, really.
Yeah, can you recall any incidents where, you and Julian were, came to the attention of the authorities in those days? Because this was taken quite seriously, as I suppose it probably still is now. Here in the UK, we've got our own dedicated nuclear police that sort of, keep an eye on activists very closely and, guard these trains. I suppose they think that maybe some sort of terrorist is going to attack them or something.
Oh, I don't know. Julian's the intensity of Julian's activity and his particular intellectual depth and skills with computers may have made him a focus of the authorities. As far as I'm concerned, they never bothered me at all. They may have looked at me or whatever, but I just simply take no notice. I'm essentially harmless, as I'm not a great organizer, or I don't have vast amounts of money behind me, or I don't like to join organizations. So my work and protest against the armaments and, you know, nuclear industry are just quiet and persistent.
Well, do you yourself, and from what you know about Julian, make the connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons? Because that was certainly something that I can remember back in the day. Everybody was saying, well, you know, this nuclear power stuff is really just about weapons. And now, like I say, we've got this whole sort of move now that for example, where we are here in Bristol, we've got an enormous, massive project going on to build another new nuclear power station.
Yeah, it's kind of turned around altogether as people have realized that, I don't know, you know, one can speculate the reasons, but it seems as though that fossil energy supply is finite, so you've got to make some preparation. And in Northern Europe, renewables aren't sufficient to keep the people warm. Now, this year and next year, there'll be a crisis in supply of energy to keep people warm and keep cars on the road. In particular, in the UK and Europe, you pay so much money for heating and warming, you know, warming water and so on, than much more than we do. I think the average is, from memory, 38 cents a kilowatt hour. We pay in Australia about 18 cents a kilowatt hour. In Russia, I think they pay 12 cents a kilowatt hour. So access to energy is the foundation of an industrial economy. So they find that they've got to, you know, solve these problems, I guess.
Crikey. Well, that's like we're paying three times more than the Russians and twice as much as you guys in Australia.
Yeah.
A little bit nerve-wracking. I can remember also Henry Kissinger's famous quote, you control the energy, you control the nations. And he also said, you control the food, you control the people. But that's, you know, you do wonder whether these energy prices being jacked up is going to simply mean that people cannot afford to live, you know, or heat their homes. But anyway, look, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about Julian. And I just wonder how you think this latest hearing has gone, because I'm struck by the fact that there's been so little press coverage of it. We've had wall to wall about Glasgow, the COP26 this week, but virtually nothing about Julian. And what there's been, I've seen in The Independent yesterday, they published what I thought immediately was a terrific article talking about Jeremy Corbyn saying that Julian has committed no crime and that he should be released. And all of a sudden, over the next few hours, couple of hours, the headline changed to something a bit more innocuous, something that one of the lawyers had said. So it seems almost Orwellian. You know, you've got the journalist writing an article and somebody else, quite who God knows, has come along and said, oh, we don't like the sound of that. It's, legally questionable or whatever. Has Julian committed a crime? Well, of course, we know he hasn't committed any British crime, and yet he's still in prison. So anyway, how have these hearings gone the last couple of days? I understand Wednesday was the prosecution and the defence on Thursday.
Well, if I could characterise this as a sort of, because it's Halloween or Hallows Day soon, I could characterise this as a sort of zombie prosecution and persecution of Julian Sims to refuse to die. You know, it's mired in scandal one after the other, starting with the Crown Prosecuting Service and the Swedish Prosecuting Authority conspiring with each other to keep Julian in the embassy and Julian's lawyers fighting in Sweden to get the Swedish federal court to advance the case, to instruct the prosecutor to advance the case. This goes on for four Swedish prosecutors for 7.5 years. And finally, after the 9th year, the Swedish prosecuting authority retires from the field, embarrassed and disgraced. Then the FBI gets itself involved in Iceland and bribes a convicted paedophile and fraudster to give evidence against Julian, which a month or so later, the person concerned recants the evidence in its entirety, and the Icelandic government arrests him and put him in jail for a continuous crime spree, which the FBI guaranteed that he would be immune from persecution from. The next one is the CIA spying Julian and suborning the UC Global, the security firm that's supposed to look after Julian's security and the security in the embassy. So they bribe them. The next one is that the CIA get together with their geniuses and plan to kill Julian, shoot Julian, have a shootout in the streets of London, shoot the tires from an aeroplane, or if an aeroplane's trying to take off or hover a helicopter over an aeroplane that may be rescuing Julian, all of this absurd stuff, which all of a sudden the United Kingdom Secret Services say, yeah, no, you can't do that, fellas. We'll do it for you. And so there's another tremendous scandal bringing just after the disgrace that's heaped on the Swedish prosecuting authority, bringing disgrace to the Crown Prosecuting Service and the prosecutors here in the UK. You'd think that these three elements, like the FBI in Iceland, the Swedish Prosecuting Authority and Crown Prosecuting Services conspiracy, the CIA suborning and bribing UC Global, the security firm, then the CIA embarking upon these mad ideas itself with the involvement of MI6. You'd think the thing would just die. And then you add to this teetering mountain of scandal the fact that Julian hasn't committed a crime. He's not a US citizen. So the charges are espionage charges. And then another scandal emerges, that in particular the treaty between the extradition treaty between the United States and the UK specifically mentions not to extradite for political crimes, which of course espionage accusation is a political crime. Then you get another layer of scandal, that the New York Times, the Washington Post, El Pais, that's the Spanish newspaper, Le Monde, the French newspaper, Der Spiegel, the German newspaper, and The Guardian, the English newspaper, all concurrently printed exactly the same stuff as Julian did the day before, a few hours before Julian published it and WikiLeaks published it. And it's it just can't get any madder, Tony, than what these people are going on with. The latest 2 days of hearing were held in the Chief Justice of England and Wales Court, is the most powerful judge in England and Wales. So one would be hoping that the people who administer law in the United Kingdom want to stop this mess and stop the disgrace that's seeping in to the administration of law in the UK. Now, ordinary people, of course, we have busy lives and have to look after our kids and wives and lovers. Ordinary people don't have time to absorb all this stuff. However, people engaged in the administration of other states in the world see it. That's their job, to look at what's happening in the UK and become aware that you can't rely upon the legal administration in the UK. This is a very important matter, because there's probably, I don't know how much at the moment, but probably about $1 trillion of contracts written in the city of London each year, and often they fall into disrepute. And having a legal system which has a reputation of being able to fairly adjudicate disputes is vital. It seems to me, you know, Tony, the odds to nothing that to get out of this mess as quickly as possible, the administration of law in the UK must see the light and stop it in its tracks.
What about the scene in the court?
Well, the prosecutor had the first dibs, if you can have the image, I mean, there's plenty of really accurate stuff online for people to read, but I sort of just deal with the poetry, and the image is that the prosecutor lives in fairyland, that the United States jail system is okay, and the prosecutor went to the extent of saying that provisions are made for solitary recreation in the cells. And, you know, spare me this stuff, you know, solitary recreation, that means you're locked up all the time, you're staring at a wall, you get a pencil to write notes to yourself or something like that. But equally, they have a system in the United States called SAMS, the Special Administrative Measures, and that's decided by the Attorney General and the CIA. If the Attorney General and the CIA think that you'll reveal a secret or something to another prisoner, they whack you under SAMS. The SAMS has about 80 prisoners in the United States under its auspices, and they're all in solitary confinement. But there are other means of solitary confinement in the United States. There's about 80,000 people. I mean, there's 2.4 million people in jails in the United States. It's particularly distressing administration of justice and locking that 7 times more people than the United Kingdom up in jails. And those jails are used as slave labor to produce clothing or number plates. Anyway, whatever contract the local manufacturing industry can use prisoners for, because they only get paid $4 an hour. So you see the prosecutor living in fairyland and actually cherry picking from the four weeks of evidence last September, cherry picking to construct a case which he simply doesn't have. But, you know, he makes these assertions eloquently, and the structure is that people actually have to take notice of him. The second day, Edward Fitzgerald and Mark Summers, you know, flayed the assertions of James Lewis, the UK prosecutor, well, that was a relief to hear. They have a summing up. So the prosecutor gets half an hour at the end of the defense's dissertation, and similarly, the defense gets half an hour after the prosecutor's dissertation. They gave the prosecutor an extra time, but he didn't have enough material to fill the time and had to decline the use of that time, such as the quality of the material that he has. But if I could just say that there's plenty of really good commentary online on Twitter, a blow-by-blow account, Kevin Costola and Richard Medhurst, just to name two. So if people want to follow it in that sort of detail, I deal with the overall of it because I have not a legal mind, and also the poetry of the matter, to see an innocent man now in the 12th year of his arbitrary detention, again in another court case after a deluge of scandal. So that's what I deal with, the insistence that I'll give you a couple more on this, as a matter of fact. One of the great inventions of the, or sort of no inventions, great creations of the English-speaking peoples was in 1207, the Magna Carta, which put a system of laws, a shield, if you want, between the sovereign and the people. And that, over the years, improved and improved and improved, so that now every nation in the world adopts a system of laws to guide the relationship between the state and the people. But this is, in the case of Julian, just been abandoned. And I think that that's not a good sign for this great and magnificent gift of the English-speaking people. Another thing is that another gift that the English-speaking people made is through Percy Shelley, the poet, where in Prometheus Unbound, he illuminated for us the relationship between freedom and knowledge. If you've got to get freedom, you need knowledge. And this is in Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and all of those people who constitute WikiLeaks, that's what they do. They bring knowledge of the actions of corporations and states so that you can evaluate for yourself what your state or what your corporations are doing and make decisions for yourself and your family and your community, and you enable yourself to have erudite, knowledgeable conversations between each other to see what's cooking and how to go about life. These are vital things. Another thing is that after the 1945 catastrophe wars, the people of the world got together and built a thing called the United Nations, wherein states, through law, could sort out their differences and hopefully where they came into competition to work out how that competition could be a benefit to both parties, a win-win situation, to use a current aphorism, win-win. So that has fallen into disrepute as well. In the case of Julian Assange, the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention on the 2018 February, said that Julian was arbitrarily detained. The United Kingdom protested. That protest failed. Then the United Kingdom just said, the Crown Prosecuting Service said, well, we're not interested in what the UN says. Then the United Nations Rapporteur on Torture, Professor Nils Melzer, his professor of law at Glasgow University, said that Julian was a victim of psychological torture over a period of 10 years of smears and arbitrary detention. Report is derided in court. It was derided in court the day before yesterday by the Crown Prosecuting Service prosecutor, James Lewis. This great thing, the United Nations, ought to be treated with respect. And the next one is the conventions of asylum. Julian dragged out of the embassy as an asylee, Duncan, the minister at the time, writes an autobiography boasting of how he'd managed to bribe the president of Ecuador to contravene the conventions of asylum and not go through the process of withdrawing asylum from Julian, just say that, you know, it's fine, you can go in and arrest him. I mean, this is a terrible, terrible thing to do to these great civil artifacts that took the catastrophe of the Second World War to build. And then those very states that built them abandoned them. It's just not good.
Well, it's probably partly because the generation in charge now doesn't actually remember war, and it maybe doesn't even bother reading its history books. But look, one of the things that got me interested in journalism originally was a series by Duncan Campbell called Secret Society, which the BBC broadcast back in the 1987, I think it was. Yes. And this whole thing of secrecy, I mean, he was looking, for example, there was even the BBC offices, I remember, in Scotland were raided by Special Branch to take all of the tapes and everything as they were making the programme. And, you know, that was the sort of TV that was really good fun to watch. And I thought, this is a great and interesting institution. But secrecy, you know, I think it's Carl Jung that said the maintenance of secrets is like a psychic poison that alienates their possessor from the community. And this whole thing of secrecy is one of the things that Julian was doing his best in the public interest note to penetrate, really. And it's actually what journalists should do. And it's now what journalists generally don't do. So there are all sorts of lines that they don't cross, like, oh, gosh, you know, my editor might not like this or whatever. You know, they know that there's a massive area and a growing area that they have no jurisdiction whatsoever, and they better keep their mouths shut. Now, that used to be really just kind of, you know, national security and military intelligence. But since the Thatcher era in the 1980s, you know, so much has been privatized of our infrastructure that we're now looking at private businesses covering commercial confidentiality with a massive amount, and of course, massive contracts that we're now used to run the entire nation, that they are also secret. So what Julian's done is so important, I think, personally, that, you know, one of his most important revelations through WikiLeaks, and what a terrific organization and operation it was, there's nothing really doing that nowadays, is this Vault 7 back in 2017, which revealed all sorts of things. I mean, this is all kind of Orwellian crazy stuff, but we were all amazed to see that some of our fears about technology were actually true. Things like being able to hack aircraft in order to bring them down, being able to hack cars in order to force car crashes. And I think it was 2013 that we had the US journalist who'd written a book about the generals in Afghanistan, or one particular general. He finds his car accelerating in LA up to 80 miles an hour. And there's a bit of police footage because he shot past a police car where you can clearly see he's got his foot on the brakes, you know, as he's doing 80 miles an hour and accelerating. And then the car swerves and crashes into a tree and kills him as an investigative journalist out of the way. Also, simple things like being able to hack into a locomotive to take over control of it from the driver and crash a train. All these things being actually part of a program by the Central Intelligence Agency in order to carry out covert assassinations. Now, this is the sort of thing that the world needs to know about. Certainly domestic citizens need to know about. And I would, you know, consider that, you know, since the military adventures in the Middle East by NATO, by US mainly and Britain have hit the buffers in Syria, that much of this machinery, because they realize that they can't really take on the Russians and the Chinese, you know, that much of this machinery is starting to be turned on us, John.
Yeah, I see that. I'm not a technician, and I do understand a little bit about Vault 7. But what the narrative I like to use about secrets and about the revelations that WikiLeaks, and in this case at Chelsea Manning, because Julian is only charged with those original ones, not Vault 7, okay, is this, that when the revelations came, the Iraq war files, the Afghan war files, the Guantanamo Bay files, slowly, and the cables, slowly, the information therein and the wretchedness of the behavior of officials slowly seeped into the consciousness in one way or another of the populations of the West, in the United Kingdom, United States, Australia. And this result in the people losing interest in supporting these wars. And in the United States, they invented the out of the mass, and wasn't top down, a statement, never ending wars. The wars had to end because the support for them disappeared. It just drifted away. It wasn't a phenomenon of people marching in the street. It's a phenomenon of us withdrawing support in one way or another. Nobody's interested in these wars. And so they end. Now they're out of Afghanistan in another great catastrophe of strategic and organized withdrawal of people from Afghanistan, a disaster. Didn't even tell the United Kingdom. And, you know, shake your head in shame that the United Kingdom running around the place saying, we're great friends, and then not decently involved in the withdrawal of their troops from Afghanistan. Their withdrawal from Iraq, it's over, it's gone. The Guantanamo Bay, every other day you see a note in the paper that they're trying to somehow place the prisoners in there and close the place. This boil, this on the face of the law administration. So that's how I read the narrative of the revelation of secrets and the ability of us to evaluate what these states are doing in our name or what they're not doing. With Vault 7, of course, the manipulation of our lives, it takes another course, and that's the digital course. We can spend an hour or so talking about the digitalization of economy and our lives.
One of the things that, you know, is one of the most notable is this whole thing about TV spying on us. I mean, how Orwellian is that? Amazing. But anyway, look, let's get back to Julian again, because he's the main concern here. And I see, you know, there's an amazing mural in Berlin of him with his press gear being nailed to the cross, which it seems that echoes right around the world. And of course, the fact that has such resonance is absolutely damning. And as you said, you know, who could trust Britain again if they're prepared to carry on with this appalling crucifixion, you know? Anyway, what about him himself and his appearance? How is he? And, you know,
he didn't look too good during the hearing. On the first day, he came into the video booth at Belmarsh for an hour and then disappeared and then came back a little late in the afternoon. But yesterday he wasn't there at all. And I believe they've increased his medication. So he's a bit down at the moment. Well, more than a bit. But anyway, that's his circumstance. He's lost a bit of weight. I'll know more on the second and the fourth when I, you know, get an opportunity to go and say hello.
What's that sort of procedure in a nutshell? What's that sort of procedure like in Belmarsh? I presume
it's a maximum security prison, you know. It's designed for terrorists in particular. 36% of the population there are rapists of one sort or another. The procedure is that you make a booking and then you take everything out of your pocket except notes, not silver, except notes totaling maximum £20. They have a cafeteria inside. I don't think the cafeteria's used since COVID. Then you go through four gates, and each gate there's a security check, and then you then the X-ray machine, and then a physical tap down, and then your shoes. You take off your shoes. You're not allowed to have any paper. We're not allowed to have anything except a maximum £20 note. You take your belt off, and so on.
And how much time do you get to spend with Julian?
Usually about 45 minutes. Yeah. They say it's an hour and a half, but it never is. You know, sometimes they forget to bring Julian down. They have to remind them. It's pretty grim, you know. It's a maximum security prison. So anything that you can imagine that they would do to make life as constrained as possible so that there's no risks taken. Also, the theatre of no risks. You go through these electronic portals, you search, then you X-rays, and then you searched again, and then you take your shoes off to see if there's any paper in them. All of those, the theatre of oppression and intimidation is complete. Sometimes a prisoner in the meeting room will go a bit nuts over some sort of frustration or other, and six guards will push him to the ground, you know, generally. Indicate to him that, you know, anything outside of the law, anything outside of the rules or regulations is going to be hit real hard. So that's the circumstances in a maximum security prison.
Okay, and where do we go from here? When are we going to hear a result from this hearing?
Chief Judge didn't indicate the amount of time. I've been told December. Somebody, another lawyer, said January. And then last night, a lawyer rang me up and said, oh, it should be only 2 weeks. So, Tony, I don't know.
We'll better watch this space, John. Just like to say thank you ever so much for joining us.
Tony, thank you. It's been a pleasure.